So everyone should have a handout, yes, by now? Yes, yes. On the front is a kind of couple of key quotes that I'll be speaking to as we go along. On the back are a kind of set of the key thematic issues in Mrs. Dalloway, along with quite an extensive secondary reading list. Don't worry, you're not supposed to read it all. It's just to outline different theoretical approaches to Wolfe and her writing, so that if you're interested in a certain theme, certain idea, a certain critical angle, you can take that up very quickly by looking at the right kind of material. Okay? Can I have a show of hands, first of all, for anyone who's read a Virginia Woolf novel other than the one we're reading this week? All right, keep your hands up for me. Can I have extra people's hands up who've seen something like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf as a play or as a film? All right, keep them up. And can I have hands up for people who may have seen a film adaptation, something like A Room of One's Own, or very recently the film The Hours? Okay, and keep them up so you get an arm ache while I get a voice ache. And lastly, hands up for people who actually did know who Virginia Woolf was before they started this course, had some awareness of her. Yes. Can everyone look around and see how that's pretty much nearly everyone in the room? So my general opener as a starting point is that Virginia Woolf has a kind of place in our popular cultural imagination, that as students of English literature, we come to Virginia Woolf knowing something about her, or at least thinking we know something about her. We have this kind of assumed relationship with Virginia Woolf, yes? Yes, right. She's kind of assumed to be an icon of modernism, or a modern icon. And we really need to reflect on that cultural position before we begin to look critically at her work. We need to think specifically about the way that her popular cultural position intersects with ideas of Englishness, English literature, and feminism, and how those three things come together in Woolf's persona as it's sold to us as literary students or students of literature. We might think specifically, actually, of the reclamation of Woolf that comes in the 1970s, as feminists move to advance their own concerns. They reclaim Woolf as one of their own, as a very significant female writer, and that's really put her to the fore of modernist studies as the singular female author of British modernism. That also means, though, that she kind of overshadows some of the other key figures, and for us that's often the Americans. So people like Gertrude Stein, HD, i.e. Hilda Doolittle, and Juana Barnes, who all have very important key texts or pieces of work, are actually overshadowed in our consciousness by the presence of Virginia Woolf. And we should be very sensitive to that in a course like this, where it's a broad survey, we're skipping through people very quickly, and that often means we're skipping out people very quickly. So we should also think about the fact that when we come to Woolf, we don't come to her academically the first time. Most of us come to her kind of through kind of pop cultural references, through long scarves and, you know, dark tights. Those kind of reference points are what we get to. But actually, she has a separate, perhaps more interesting academic identity that has lots of things filtering through her writing, but doesn't necessarily reduce her to the image that we see very often. So as I'm lacking my slides, I'm going to talk you through until we get some impetus. Woolf's real public persona signifies for us things like highbrow modernism, things like bohemianism, literary London, Bloomsbury, snobbery, elitism, aesthetic experimentation, madness, feminism, and lesbianism. So all those things come in the package of what we know Virginia Woolf to be. So her life and work are sites for the investigation of modernist aesthetics, but also issues around madness, creativity, psychoanalysis, Freudian thinking, female independence, the independence of the female writer, questions of gender, the colonial collapse of England and its empire, male and female relations, and the impact of war. So we get very quickly a density of issues cycling around, both from her presence in the world and from the text that she's offering up. So her image, as it's passed into popular currency, has been used even to sell things. So I think that Waitrose in Bloomsbury used her image to open a store, and that pretty much tells us what we need to know about the kind of class patterns and the expansion of capitalism using the image of Virginia Woolf. Okay? If you think about the 1962 play that we just mentioned, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and the way it became a film with, with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, we might think of the way that Wolfe's name becomes disembodied, it becomes detached from her work, it has no reference point. The text, the play text and the film are not about her, they're not about her work at all. They use her name alongside the kind of Big Bad Wolf theme tune to kind of reference the infighting that happens between couples on an academic campus. So they use her to signify this kind of soft intellectualism, this jokiness that comes from academics being at home and knowing something about literary moments. Okay? The film that we were saying about The Hours in 2002, written by David Hare, directed by Stephen Daldry, attempts to show the influence of Mrs. Dalloway as a text on Virginia Woolf herself and then two other female characters. So a Mrs. Brown character from 1950s America and then a very modern kind of mid-50s Meryl Streep version of a lady called Clarissa who's organising a party. And we have Nicole Kidman in that kind of very famous reincarnation of Virginia Woolf. So the film quite substantially changes the narrative of Mrs. Dalloway, but it does so in ways that are quite problematic and suggest to us that in manoeuvring around Woolf's life and her work, there's a flattening out that happens quite quickly in that transference from novel to film. And I'd suggest there are two real kind of points of critique that we might want to think about. Now, the first is that the film, and often our understanding of Woolf in general, the kind of cultural reference points I was suggesting, actually make her kind of more narrow, more benign, more depressed, although she kills herself, more depressed than is necessary to understand what's happening. And so we often reduce her to those biographical points. So the film captures her in 1923. It does so in a kind of singular fashion. So it doesn't show her with the kind of vibrancy of creativity we might expect. It doesn't show the kind of insight, humour or life force that kept her going through such turbulent years. The second thing that is kind of more interesting for us, perhaps, is that the novel actually doesn't allow us to understand how the narrative and the narrative techniques that have made her so significant for modernist studies actually work. So the characters move around in a way that really is an embodied movement. We see their bodies on the screen. We view them as external viewers. We fail to inhabit them in the way that we were able to inhabit the minds or the consciousnesses of the characters in the novel. And so that separates us. It puts us outside of them in a way that Woolf's literary project was not really about. So in the novel, we're much more inside a character, and we're inside the characters as we move around them in this kind of soft, shifting fashion. But actually, when you see them on the screen, you're pushed outside very quickly. And we might think of that as a kind of problem in terms of media, but we might also think that about reminding us of the strengths of Woolf's narratives. And so in the film, instead of actually having a Septimus-like figure, this kind of figure of mental distress and disintegration, they have Richard kind of re-embodied as someone who's dying from HIV so that his disease or his dis-ease becomes marked on his external person and doesn't emanate from inside out, but is outside in. And that kind of disjuncture, that kind of difference between the text and the film, you guys should get used to if, as all you raised all your hands, if you've come to that kind of thing first, and the text second, you want to be inside the text more quickly and not attached to those kind of pop cultural reference points that I was mentioning. So that long preamble is to say we should be cautious about the Woolf we already know, the kind of who's afraid of Virginia Woolf kind of cliche. And we should be aware that when this kind of popular persona, this kind of image of Woolf is offered up, it may be suggestive of cultural influences that are very particular, that are about class-based assumptions about what literature should be or what it was at the start of the century. And we might also think about the way it alludes to her writing style, but also can mask or obscure it. Okay? So those are the kind of patterns you want to be cautious of when you think you already know someone when you come to study them here. There is another kind of adaptation of Mrs. Dalloway, which is the 1998 version with Vanessa Redgrave, and it kind of points us again to this reimagining of England in the 1980s and the kind of crash of confidence that comes with reimagining England. So as England can't separate itself from its kind of imperial legacy, they look to reimagine what it was like at the start of the century. Okay? So, as I have no visuals, can you still hear me? and we have no audiovisual person still. I'll carry on, I'll talk you through what we were going to look at on the screen, but I was going to address three kind of main topics. The first being biography and context, the things that we think we know and the things that we might want to use to contextualise Mrs. Dalloway. And then the second thing being the change of the novel, the way that she really pushes for change and is an innovative writer in that move. And thirdly, Mrs. Dalloway, some of the kind of key themes, ideas and issues, and they're marked on the back of your handout. So the other thing to think about is that there are two really helpful kind of critical introductions or kind of overviews of Woolf's writing that will help you get a handle on her academically very quickly. And so the first is the kind of Cambridge Companion to Virginia Woolf, the things that we keep pointing you to all the time because we've paid a license fee, so you can access them very quickly online. But also there's a very recent collection by Anna Snaith called Palgrave Advances Virginia Woolf Studies. And lots of what I say actually will be filled out in more academic detail in that kind of collection. Okay? Are you crisp? Ah, I'm going to get some audio and visual. So, I don't think this is. I don't know if it is recording. And then, do you want to check that this is recording? Got it? Yay.
Okay.
Thank you. So now we have a static recording for everyone who can't come. So, yeah, thanks. We just like to say that wasn't my technical incompetence, although it looks like it. So now we have two halves of recording that they're going to cut together. So, as I was trying to suggest earlier, we have pictures, just to remind us, and that would have been much quicker, wouldn't it? And biography and context, changing the novel, and Mrs. Dalloway as text. So the biographical stuff, which is readily available, and really comes down to us through a set of key biographies. So the kind of Quentin Bell biography of the 1970s, which is Virginia Woolf's nephew, and a little bit more recently in the 1990s, Hermione Lee's biography, both of which are on your handout. And Woolf is known for coming from a kind of upper middle class family with strong literary connections, being based in London in her childhood, holidaying in Cornwall, and having that kind of impression of moving from the city to the country's edge as a kind of common pattern. And that's something that she seems to pick up in her writing, this attachment to waves, to water, to things that you would have seen in her prose. And there's a series of family deaths that culminate in 1904 with the death of her father. And the kind of discussions that come around Woolf's family revolve around the idea of stability, of Victorian acceptance, and of them being a very well-connected family. But at the same time, recent criticism has kind of drawn attention to the way in which this family pattern, where both parents have already been married, where there's a set of kind of step-siblings as well as biological siblings, may have meant that Woolf was quite substantially abused. And there's a couple of texts, and there's a Louise DeSalvo book that addresses the ideas of childhood abuse in her writing that's caused kind of quite a bit of a backlash, and it is quite divided in terms of critical response. But those are issues that are kind of working around Woolf's narrative sometimes, and some of her own writings draw our attention to that. And so she's well known for these kind of moments of depression, the kind of breakdown scenes that we see in the films. And she did struggle with this in a kind of cyclical way, often at the end of a writing process, often when she'd finished a project, okay? But that's something that she's always holding on to. And you can see in the depictions of Septimus and lots of her other characters, this sense of anguish, this sense of an anguish that's tied to despair, that's never released, but is not always at the front, is not always the driving force, but sometimes takes over. And you can see that kind of ebb and flow of it rising and then falling away again in Clarissa herself. And then so her relationship with the Bloomsbury Group is the thing that some of you may know less about, in that when they move away from Hyde Park Gate, their family home, so her and her biological sister Vanessa, they move to Gordon Square in Bloomsbury. And after that point, she becomes the kind of centre of the key kind of intellectual group, as it were, who are friends and kind of partners in a project for creating a new kind of literary impetus. So we wouldn't describe them as a kind of homogenous collective, but we would suggest that they're a unified or kind of directed group sharing friendship, aesthetic interests, concerns with pacifism, economics, and what we might say as progressive attitudes towards personal freedom, things like sex, women's rights, and homosexuality. And so the kind of people we're talking about would be generationally E.M. Forster precedes them, but is kind of in with them, though he considers himself outside sometimes. But then there's Leonard Woolf, who Virginia, as Virginia Stevens, marries in 1912. Then Clive Bell, who marries Vanessa, Virginia Woolf's sister. And then other figures like Linton Strachey, John Maynard Keynes, and also the painters like Duncan Grant and Roger Fry. So all came from upper middle class families. Nearly all of the men went to Cambridge. This kind of sense of a narrow class parameter and a strong sense of privilege have actually been criticized repeatedly, I would say convincingly, and ongoing and going and going again. So you guys might think of, have people done F.R. Leavis yet for modes of reading? Because you might come to that this year. He's someone who kind of leads this kind of critique about what they stand for and what they're not doing in the world in terms of worldly concerns. So the group's obviously punctured by the First World War, but they kind of go on and they have kind of this kind of generational renewal through the 20s up to the late 30s. And importantly for us, kind of the 1970 moment when the Hogarth Press is set up by Virginia Woolf and Leonard Woolf, both to further her own writing and to really provide an outlet for the kind of literature that they're interested in, is helpful for us to understand because of the kind of people it publishes. So quite famously, it gives us kind of one of the first new and translated versions of Freud's work. And given that you've studied T.S. Eliot recently, you might want to know that Virginia Woolf is supposed to have set the, you know, the typeface for the 1923 Hogarth edition of The Wasteland. And so you can see that the intersection between Woolf and kind of editorial work, publishing work, this kind of central group of intellectual and kind of literary figures is really moving things on in London in terms of change, in terms of literary change. And T.S. Eliot, though not one of them, was quite close to them and commented, and this is one of the first comments on your handout, that on her death he reflected to say that the future will arrive at a permanent estimate of the place of Virginia Woolf's novels in the history of English literature, and it will also be furnished with enough documents to understand what her work meant to her contemporaries. It will also, through letters and memoirs, have more than fugitive glimpses of her personality. Virginia Woolf was the centre, not merely of an esoteric group, but of the literary life of London. And so you can see T.S. Eliot, someone who we see to be very central to this modernist poetic shift, giving, you might say, due reference to Virginia Woolf's centrality to what's happening in terms of literary modernism as prose. And so we might think of a few kind of contextualizing gestures. Because we're looking at Mrs. Dalloway, we don't need to look at the whole span, but you might want to focus on a couple of particular points or moments. So 1910 and 1923 to 25 seem to be key areas chronologically for Woolf. And Woolf's very famous essay, Mr. Bennet and Mrs. Brown, which was a kind of riposte to Arnold Bennett's attack that she couldn't depict characters and they had no real depth to them, described how she felt the world changed on or about December 1910, suggesting that human character changed. All human relations have shifted, those between masters and servants, husbands and wives, parents and children. And when human relations change, there is at the same time a change in religion, conduct, politics and literature, okay? And she suggests it's on or about that, so you see her kind of shifting around even in that construction, suggesting it doesn't have to be specifically at that moment, but it's around this kind of time, this time when the Edwardian period is coming to a close and something else is beginning. So I wanted to draw attention to a couple of things that happened in 1910 that all seem to be cycling around Woolf and her influence upon us. And so in 1910, there's this very famous hoax that the Bloomsbury set pull off, which kind of gets them some kind of recognition, some kind of public presence, and they manage to trick the Navy into allowing the Abyssinian royals to visit the key fighting ship, which is the HMS Dreadnought, even though the Abyssinian royals are people like Virginia Woolf dressed up in turbans and costumes. And so they manage to pull it off, and they pull it off well, and they get kind of pressed for this. And then later on in the year, you get this real pivotal turning point in the middle of the year where King Edward VII dies and we have the close of the Edwardian period. And for us, typically the Edwardian period is imagined in the kind of glowing golden hue of a golden period. And actually, afterwards, lots of critics and lots of historians have looked back at that as a time of internal turmoil that hasn't yet come to the surface. And for us, it's interesting that when a generation later, people are looking back on this. So, for example, George Dangerfield's very famous book called The Strange Death of Liberal England, they're agreeing with Virginia Woolf that something did take place in 1910 or just thereabouts, that there was this change in manner, that there was this step up in pace, that it was before the war was really on the horizon, but it was at a time when England and Englishness was up for grabs and there was some kind of cycle of change accelerating in those terms. And so then we come to the ascension of George V, obviously the Georgian period begins. And for Woolf and her connections, there's a very famous exhibition called Manet and the Post-Impressionists, where Roger Fry, one of the artists in the Bloomsbury group, puts together a set of paintings that are supposed to depict the moment from Manet onwards in terms of artistic expression. So do people know what Impressionism looks like in terms of art? Yay or nay, shake heads or don't? Yes, you do. So light, bright, kind of these moments where singular moments are captured strongly. Bright colours, normally whites, pinks, with light reflecting, bouncing, moving. And post-impressionism is those things continued, but typically with more of a kind of geometric kind of interest, a kind of sharper, stronger point of contrast. So not the kind of soft things you might associate Monet with, but things like Gauguin and similar kind of artists. And lots of work has drawn attention to the similarity between Woolf and her interest in kind of visual depictions and her ideas about luminescence with post-impressionist works. And so this, coming at the same time as her direct engagement with the women's movement, suggests that all these factors are coming together for her at this turning point, what she later sees as a turning point. So the hoax of the Bloomsbury group, the falling away of the Edwardian period, the post-impressionist kind of arrival and her engagement with the women's movement. Okay, and so later in kind of 1938, Woolf does suggest that the word feminism should be burned, it should be destroyed, but perhaps this is more about her concern with equality, with freedom, with expansive living than it is with a refusal of women as equals. She doesn't really like the term, she kind of thinks it's outmoded very quickly. And she did engage very practically, but she might be someone who raises immediate questions about any narrow parameters for feminism. And so when we think about 23 to 25, there's lots happening there for her, in particular in terms of publication. It's when her two most famous articles emerge in collections, so Mr. Bennet and Mrs. Brown, and also Modern Fiction. And it's also the transition between Mrs. Dalloway, the 1923 kind of draft version that's called The Hours, through to Mrs. Dalloway's publication. And in the middle of that period, in 1924, when she leaves Richmond in this kind of exile that is about self-preservation, this kind of suburban seclusion that occurs, she goes back to London. But in 1924, she attends the kind of Empire exhibition that's held in London. And so she can see for herself the kind of shorthand reductionist reference points that are used to kind of get the world into an image and then have it on display in the centre of London, making London that kind of cultural centre point again, but a centre point based on theft and reduction and stereotype and cliché. And so for her, there's kind of a long trajectory to her writing. I've kind of just picked out a few things that you want to think about in terms of 1905, really beginning as a professional writer and moving through her key novels up to 1925 for us, and then onwards through to The Lighthouse and all the way up to the kind of between the acts at the moment of her death when she does commit suicide in 1941, and The Common Reader being her one of her key collections of essays coming out in 1925. And this kind of turning moment, the kind of 23 to 25 period, I would want to identify as the moment where in 1924, alongside the Empire Exhibition, Ramsay MacDonald becomes this kind of Labour Prime Minister, and suggests that that this is a gap before we get to the general strike of 1926 and the kind of mass social upheaval that comes with that and the reassessing of kind of class-based privileges that comes with that. This is just before. And so Virginia Woolf has this very, very famous description of how she wants to push for change. So having written abundantly and also being very concerned with pushing for literary change, with having novels that do something different, her essay retitled Modern Fiction addresses the kind of generational shift that she's pushing for and that she sees coming through writers after 1910. And so you can see, if you want to look down, because it's quite lengthy, at your handout for me. And so you can see her saying that she's refusing the kind of stance offered by people like H.G. Wells and Arnold Bennett, because they're materialists, because they believe in the body, because they represent plots as about people moving through space. And these are the kind of people we might associate with her father's generation. And then she comes to the question about what must novels be then, or why must they be like this? And she describes a day in the life of, in a very similar way to we experience it in Mrs. Dalloway. And so she says, look within, and life, it seems, is very far from being like this. Examine for a moment an ordinary mind on an ordinary day. The mind receives a myriad of impressions, trivial, fantastic, evanescent, or engaged with the sharpness of steel. And she goes on, and you can read through this kind of patterning out that she gets of this internalized view of the world, this view from inside out, as I was suggesting. And she says, life is not a series of gig lamps symmetrically arranged. Life is a luminous halo, a semi-transparent envelope surrounding us from the beginning of consciousness to the end. And some of you might have seen this quote before, I would hope, actually. But we see how it kind of draws together lots of the kind of things that we might consider as being significant to Mrs. Dalloway, the idea of light, the idea of movement, the idea of a semi-transparent presence, where what's outside and what's inside is somehow often being held in a buffer zone in between, where consciousness is about an individual consciousness and a collective consciousness all of the time, how it moves from one person to another but seems to capture a collective feeling very often. And so she says that the proper stuff of fiction doesn't exist, that everything, every detail from the world is what fiction should be made up of. And so we see her throwing aside the kind of generation that comes before her and attempting to use these things in her own prose, and actually in the same article, the same essay, drawing our attention to the way that James Joyce does do these things in Portrait of an Artist. So she suggests that actually Joyce is spiritual. Where the generation that came before was materialist, Joyce is spiritual. He is concerned with at all costs to the flickering of the innermost flame which flashes its messages through the brain. So he is concerned with this flash of a flame that comes through the brain, is effectively the rhyme she's making. And you see this kind of idea of a glimmer, of a fleeting moment, captured quickly, in detail, expresses a kind of spiritual force. And you see her aligning herself with that and that kind of thinking and that kind of prose at the expense of those who came before. And so, as I say, in Mozarini again, some of you might know about Auerbach's and his very famous text called Mimesis, which is this kind of immense, intense extravaganza of detailed critical investigation. And the last chapter addresses Virginia Woolf and her writing or narratological style. And he identifies three defining characteristics for Woolf. And I've kind of listed them here, because they're easier for you to write down. But it's multi-personal representations of consciousness. There's lots of people having their consciousnesses represented singularly and collectively, almost simultaneously, almost all the time. And then the second point being the polyphonic and multi-layered handling of time. That time is polymorphous, that time is flexible, that time is layered, that time is internal and external to a person. That it gives structure, but it also moves in the prose as the person moves through their thinking, at the pace of their thinking, very often. And thirdly, the discovery of the significance in the random occurrence and minor happenings. So minor happenings gesture to the previous quote with this kind of, you know, everyday details are part of our story. Everyday details make up a novel. But also the random occurrence. And we see in Mrs. Dalloway very often it's the random links between characters, those seemingly kind of stretchy connections between Septimus and Clarissa are really about much more than just passing each other in a city or being vaguely near each other in terms of location. They're about understanding and about similar kind of feelings and about being couched in a milieu that keeps them pushing together within a city. And so Mitchell Lesker, the author of Virginia Woolf's Lighthouse, which is on the back of your handout as well, described how the kind of common element in her work is to stay with the human, that she focuses upon what's human in each of her narratives. And he sees her as a close writer, conveying small details and thoughts constantly through nuance and suggestion and overlap and repetition and connection. So it's not just a singular person's thoughts running very quickly forward. It's about nuance and sidestep. It's about gestures outwards and reference points that speak to the character internally again. And so to come to Mrs. Dalloway itself, I've kind of given you a long list because I didn't want to give you a singular sustained reading on a particular theme, aspect, dimension, because there's so much going on. You should try and get to kind of decide for yourself what you're most interested in the text. But so you can see here, the things that I've kind of marked out, time and its marked passages, which I would link to the age and the passing of an age. We obviously know about the kind of sounding of Big Ben, the kind of structure that gives the text, the way in which the day is a building up to a party, but it's also a counting down to a party. It's a building up to death, but it's a counting down to death. And at the same time, these kind of large structures of time are kind of running alongside very small pockets, very small moments of thinking, which seems to stretch out expansively, covering decades, covering, you know, a war and an experience of 18-year-olds failing to get together at a very big house. So we see time having large significance and having small, tiny, pocketed moments. And we see Rezia, Septimus's wife, saying it is time, and Septimus receiving that comment and playing upon it as if there's an ode to time to be had, some kind of mournful, poetic recuperation of time passing. And if you think again about T.S. Eliot and the hurry up, please, it's time, this kind of echoing from the past, echoing into the present, and suggesting that we can't get to the future very easily, seems to cycle back round here as well, through Septimus and through that exchange. Class, wealth, and privilege, take it or leave it, for me this is kind of central. But the party as the idea of self-preservation, as the idea of the mask that Clarissa maintains in order to survive. So the idea that her elation at the party is really the negation of her isolation, that she will be with people and therefore not alone if she makes the party a success. So that kind of buffering and the kind of indulgence that implies in contrast to Septimus is very significant to the text. And it seems to offer a way in which we could read Woolf as being reflexive about her own cultural position, about her own class position. We could. And then war, psychology, and social consequences. One of the things that we know a lot about is the kind of literature that comes out of the First World War. Most of you will probably have some sense of the poetry, some sense of the kind of shell-shock narratives that come out, some sense of the kind of critical discussions that emerge following the First World War. But we see Virginia Woolf doing things that are both similar and perhaps more subtle, that are more domesticated and a little bit more expansive. And you see Septimus as this figure who's clinging to the past, but who's already learnt that that grasping has failed. His attempts to recapture Evans, to kind of, you know, make sure that he remembers him, have already failed because he feels numb, he feels empty, he feels hollow. And so this kind of connection to the past suggests that the war has already made the rupture incorrectable, if I can say that, that no longer is there a straightforward link between what the present is and has to offer for those people and what came before or during. And so Resia is this kind of remnants, this kind of figure of remnants that comes from the continent back with Septimus, but their failure to communicate, their inability to share a marriage in this present moment, suggests that whatever occurred during the war has not only tainted their relationship, but prevented, I would say, England and the continent from communicating. And you can see this kind of negotiation happening through the text. Other things to think about would be the kind of elegiac tone that's offered, the kind of process of mourning that comes through the text. And if we think about 1910 as this moment of an age passing, and you think about the post-war period of the kind of 1923 to 1925 moment I was suggesting, you see how there is these moments of public mourning and collective mourning at issue in Wolfe. And you see Wolfe capturing that time and time again as the kind of loss for a singular individual becomes about the loss of everyone. And you see in the shops there are these gestures towards looking at people and knowing that they also feel that a generation has been lost, or knowing that the men have not come back. And you see this kind of pushing together of references. They can all reference similar points about the war quickly. And so most of this is connected very closely to madness, depression, and suicide. And the kind of drive that Septimus has in saying, I won't be mad, or I'm not mad, he holds that, but says it again and again and again until it becomes almost an incantation spread over pages, this kind of self-reassuring gesture that I must be mad, I won't be mad. And you see him almost fall into that earlier than we anticipate, because he seems to be trying to hold on, but in that holding so tightly, he tends to lose himself. And you see when he goes to Dr. Holmes, and when he gets assessed, the kind of damning depictions of doctors don't imply anything positive about mental health or medicine. They seem to suggest that there's a problematic power relationship that Septimus can't get round, and his inability to communicate means that he only has to receive that information for it to dominate him. There's no kind of outlet, no way round it for him. He has no kind of escape route. And so the fact that he cannot feel seems to be the most significant tie between him and Clarissa. The kind of inability to feel, to connect, is what seems to be worrying Clarissa as much as it seems to be driving Septimus. And so this is the level at which their two characters are linked. The kind of concern for depression and the kind of gesture that's made in Wolfe's diaries to perhaps killing Clarissa off and instead changing to Septimus suggests that she saw them following the same path, going down the same track, but in very different circumstances. And we might think if into the lighthouse she does kill Mrs. Ramsay, and this becomes the kind of death of the angel in the house, this kind of strong, domestic, certain figure of womanhood. If she does do that into the lighthouse, then why not do it now when it's a high-class, privileged, domesticated angel of the house putting on a party? So it's kind of interesting that she delays that literary kind of mechanism until to the lighthouse when here she gets so close. And then we might want to think about the kind of interaction between politics, empire, England, and the kind of gestures towards India that are made by the presence of Peter. And so lots of the kind of interaction between inside and outside can be mapped onto the way that Richard, the husband, is the public MP, and Clarissa is the private domesticated hostess, the perfect hostess in Peter's terms. And so that public-private distinction is mapped onto their social roles, but equally puts them in a position in relation to empire, I would suggest. So we see that Richard is kind of concerned with things like the fall of the empire or tariff reform or concerns about gentlemanly behaviour and manners, and we see that Peter critiques that repeatedly even when they're young. But we see that Clarissa is the person who brings those influences back into her domestic space. So she's the one who allows Peter into her home and invites him back. And that gesture of kind of inwards movement means that Peter, representing the kind of failed imperial experience, the kind of falling in love again with England whilst abroad, with this kind of major and her wife, and he's wanting to run off with her. This kind of falling in love with England while abroad, he brings that back to the domestic space of the Dalloways. and it kind of implies this retreat inwards is about the expanse of empire collapsing in back on itself. And it might take you a while to kind of unpack that kind of argument, but I think there's quite a lot of things going on there. And a lot of the kind of concerns about behaviour are about gentlemanly behaviour, about understanding what it is to have etiquette, to be mannered. There's a couple of references to cricket and cricket bats, and this kind of fair play idea is kind of on the periphery of the text very often, but it's really structuring the way that Richard Dalloway does get on in the world, and the way that Peter almost gets on in the world, and the way that Septimus can't, doesn't, and hasn't got on in the world. And so other things about interpersonal relationships, and kind of we might link that to the role of women, the kind of public-private dimension I was saying happens quite often in that Razia seems to be the public face of Septimus. Septimus seems to be the kind of internal position of their marriage and the kind of quiet, thoughtful, but also kind of scary, anxious, and problematic husband. And you see, that is the reverse of what happens in the Clarissa and Richard relationship. The internal and external male-female positions seem to be changed. And we might think about things like the mother-daughter relationships between Clarissa and her daughter, and the way in which that kind of sense of ownership that Peter dislikes so much is kind of floating around lots of Clarissa's relationships, the idea that she needs to own, control, or perhaps be seen to be in charge of certain people, certain relationships. So the fact that her husband has lunch with someone else worries her or causes her concern, perhaps about her husband, but also perhaps about the fact that she's not invited to that lady's house as her own person, that she's the one who's excluded, not just on the kind of they may be having an affair front, but on the fact that she just no longer controls that kind of interaction. And we might think about other things in terms of the way that London's represented, and London is seen to structure or influence the relationships that are contained within it. So we see Septimus is wandering, we see them looking up at the aeroplane, and we see Clarissa wandering around again and again. These moments of exploration of the city, presenting them with a kind of space for movement, but also a space for thinking, is quite interesting. Yet for Clarissa, this immediately starts causing problems in that she immediately starts wandering through places and receiving London's kind of images and the kind of sparks of thought, only to then be troubled by what that might mean for her sense of security, for her own personality, for her certainty about those two things. And you see that London's very important in the kind of places that they move between, the kind of journeys they take, the walkways that they go on. So for Clarissa, it's going to Bond Street and being seen in this kind of fashionable space, this space of privilege. For her daughter, it's the bus journey home. So she goes on an omnibus and she's travelling through lots of kind of professional places, suggesting that she might move more quickly through these professional streets than her mother or her mother's generation. And for Peter, we see him going past things like Trafalgar Square, going down Cockspur Street, and we see him following a young woman. And these kind of gestures where the space, the location, might inflect their character or reflect their character seem to be helpful ways of reading the way that the consciousness moves from inside to outside one character to another. So we get the location influencing them, and you get their thought process coming through, and you get those two things mingling, and in the middle you kind of get this narrative movement cycling around those forces. And so we might also think about consciousness. We think about free and direct discourse, which you probably would have heard about before on your James Joyce lecture. And we would kind of want to think about the kind of patterns of repetition that come up again and again and again and again. So there's lots of things that are mentioned more than once. There's lots of things that have runs of mention. So things like flowers, roses, hyacinths, things like water, waves, this kind of feeling of something washing over you. The idea of center points and centrality comes up again and again and again. And there are moments where knives, cutting, slicing, you know, piercing through something or puncturing come up again and again. And so, as an example, before we kind of close, if you look at the way knives are used in the opening sequence and throughout, it says Lucy, which is the maid, had her work cut out for her. And then immediately afterwards, what a plunge. And then one remembered his eyes, his pocket knife, referring to Peter. And then this is Mrs. Dalloway. She sliced like a knife through everything. And Lady Bruton's face, as if it had a dial cut in impressive stone. And then he took out the pocket knife and half opened the blade. For heaven's sake, leave the knife alone, cutting people up as Clarissa did. And immediately, once you start picking them out and pulling them through a thread, you see the variations of meaning. You see how the pattern of repetition creates a pattern, but one with a multitude of possibilities. So you see the knife as a defensive gesture, as Peter coming, being uncertain, being anxious, playing with his knife as a kind of untidy habit that annoys Clarissa. But you also see him getting it half out when he's following a lady down the street in the middle of London. This has obviously problematic and illegal connotations. And you see the way that Clarissa is seen to be cutting people up, killing them, dissecting them, exposing them to view. And you see how these different plays mean that you don't know whether it's aggressive or defensive. You don't know if it's something Freudian or something about imperial power. You don't know if it's a sign of Peter's masculinity being up, as it were, and strong, or whether it's a sign of it being collapsed or failing or actually turning in upon itself. And so these are the kind of ways, when you build up these kind of clusters and these reading clusters, you can get to interesting places as you're unpacking moments of the text. I just want to draw your attention to the final kind of pattern. At the beginning, we open with Mrs. Dalloway said she would get the flowers, claiming action for herself, claiming, you know, this kind of class privilege of being able to spend loads of money on loads of flowers for her high-end party. And at the end, we close with, but where is Clarissa? And then, for there she was. And you kind of get this sense of a passing of her. Her presence becomes definite at last. In the beginning, there's action. And then there's uncertainty for a long passages in the text. And then you get the looking for her as she's in the party and Peter and Sally can't find her. And at the end, you get there she was, as she kind of is standing, is approaching them, but is definite and she's seen by them. But at the same time, this past tense means that there's a question mark over whether she still is the Clarissa that they remember. Shall we stop there and you guys can head out and I can die a death?